This is CliffCentral.com. We're beautiful.
Everybody. Tuesday morning. 8 o'clock. This is an interesting message, Ben. This is from Ines. It says, since our sport is so cuck recently, SABs have changed their lame adverts. They can still use the same idea, but they should definitely get out of advertising with sport. And instead of a protest, they should have a protest instead of a rugby game, because those are more popular than rugby matches. How do you like them apples?
Yeah, Ines, that's one view, I guess. I see where you're going.
Cock Josh is back.
He keeps disappearing.
Yeah, well, he's back properly now. Hey, bitches. I'm busy getting a blowjob while listening to your show. That must be a first.
Okay, so he's got one of those headsets from Samsung. Augmented
what a
reality.
Virtual reality thing.
Virtual reality thing. Good for you, Cock Josh.
Yeah, I believe him, Ben. Of course, we've got to give credit where it's due. Some people actually are able to make that kind of thing happen. All right, a lot of people have been talking about this, so I thought we'd just listen to it. They're playing little bits of Michelle Obama and Donald Trump to compare the two in their speeches. And you decide who you think is a nicer person, A, and B, whose speech you think matters more and means more. Here they are, Donald Trump and Michelle Obama.
These vicious claims about me of inappropriate conduct with women are totally and absolutely false.
It now seems very clear that this isn't an isolated incident. It's one of countless examples of how he has treated women his whole life. And I have to tell you that I listen to all of this, and I feel it so personally.
These lies come from outlets whose past stories and past claims have already been discredited.
The belief that you can do anything you want to a woman, it is cruel. It's frightening. And the truth is, it hurts.
The establishment and their media enablers wield control over this nation through means that are very well known. Anyone who challenges their control is deemed a sexist, a racist, a xenophobe.
It's that feeling of terror and violation that too many women have felt when someone has grabbed them or forced himself on them and they've said no, but he didn't listen.
They will lie, lie, lie. The Clintons are criminals. Remember that. They're criminals.
I'm going to throw that in.
We thought all of that was ancient history, didn't we? And so many have worked for so many years to end this kind of violence and abuse and disrespect, but here we are.
I never knew it would be this vile, that it would be this bad, that it would be this vicious. Nevertheless, I take all of these slings and arrows gladly for you.
In 2016, and we're hearing these exact same things every day on the campaign trail. We are drowning in it. And all of us are doing what women have always done. We're trying to keep our heads above water, just trying to get through it.
Our great civilization here in America and across the civilized world has come upon a moment of reckoning.
What do you reckon of that? Talk about a moment of reckoning. It's two totally different worlds being inhabited there, right?
Yeah. Blah, 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 blah.
Oh, really?
It's a sad state of affairs, but it really is just what politics is.
Speaking of politics, a lot of people are still worried and talking about the fees must fall movement and whether or not that's going to be an ongoing issue over the next couple of weeks. A lot of the leaders have been arrested, and Gabor Dlamini is going to court today, among other things, so people are talking about that. But I thought this might interest some people. Do you want to hear what Helen Ziller thinks of this? She spoke at her book launch, one of her book launches, about Fees Must Fall.
Ah.
Do you want to know what she says?
Always, Grace. She's very intelligent.
Okay, here she is. Here's Helen Ziller.
Fees Must Fall. I've got a whole chapter on the book. It's in the book on it. It's the second last chapter on this reversion to race politics. was Four started off being about fees, and it had a lot of sympathy from a lot of people, but it's now got nothing to do with fees. It's got something to do with power and control, and it's got a lot to do with the hegemony of a particular movement, and we all know where that's going to lead to. I still think that we will recover from it. We've recovered from far worse things before. But really, the critical race theorists have grabbed what they call the moral high ground in our politics. You just have to look at somebody like Mebo Dlamini and others, and you will see what I mean. So I think we need to confront them head on. And they are just as much a threat to our future as apartheid once was.
How's that, huh? Helen not pulling any punches there. She's going straight for the jugular on that one, too. Yeah, Thabo Dlamini is going to be in court today, and a lot of people are interested in what the result of that will be. He's been charged with a whole bunch of different things: public incitement to violence, carrying a dangerous weapon, destruction of property. It's quite a long list. We'll have to see what happens to him.
But I guess he's like the martyr now for the whole movement, so suits his agenda is probably being in custody right now.
Well, yeah, there are obviously a lot of these leaders who are now crying foul and saying, oh, but it's unfair, you're victimizing us, you're targeting us, we're the leaders of this movement, you're trying to kill the movement. And a lot of people saying, well, actually, it's time you guys realize that there are consequences to actions.
Exactly. This movement doesn't make you exempt from actual law. We can't leave the show today and do what he's been doing and not be arrested.
Most people would be in big trouble.
It's like a guy in Cape Town yesterday was arrested for throwing stones and feces at people.
Right.
Now, I don't care which movement it is, you can't do that. Like, it's just the law.
Well, maybe we'll get some clarity on what kind of a world we're moving into from Ralf Madeira. He's our guest this morning. We're going to speak to him about a brand new book. He's just, it's coming out today. So, you know, the timing is amazing. It's today that the first book will be released, and we'll speak to Ralf about his book, When Zuma Goes, which I think is something a lot of people are interested in. He's coming up next. You could get ready for an excellent morning in the company of touchcentral.fm, cliffcentral.com. Good morning, everybody. It's Chris Brown with the Lady in the Glass Dress. Imagine wearing a glass dress, Ben.
Gareth, that would be very uncomfortable.
Imagine wearing any kind of dress, Ben. I reckon it wouldn't really suit you.
Well, on a hot summer's day, I think summer would be quite pleasant. Glass one, though, terrible. You'd sweat a lot.
No, not very nice. All right. Ralf Madeira has just written a book. He is one of South Africa's leading political analysts and columnists. His book is called When Zuma Goes. Something that some people are dreaming about, and something that a lot of people are nervous about. I see a call from the Northwest ANC this morning saying ministers who are against Zuma must be taken out of office. They're working against him, and this is wrong. So there are a lot of people who are very much attached to the president and his reputation and his networks of patronage, and those people are very, very nervous about what the future holds. As are the people who are working against the president. Because those people clearly have a lot to lose if he stays the most important force in the ANC, which he clearly is at the moment. So there are a lot of things that we need to discuss. And I think plenty of South Africans are very concerned about what's going on in the quiet corridors of power right now. Who's calling the shots? Where the influence is coming from? And the guy to talk to this morning is Ralf Madeira. He's written a book called When Zuma Goes. Hey, Ralf. Good to have you here, man.
Morning, Gareth, and thanks for inviting me.
Sure. First of all, well done on the book. It comes out today.
Thank you.
Yeah, very exciting.
It comes out today in the bookshops.
Are you ready for this? Are you ready for the kind of backlash you're going to get from some people and the support you're going to get from others?
Well, I would say I'm ready for the backlash. I'm used to receiving nasty SMSs after doing analysis on radio and on TV.
Are you?
I'm used to it. Some people are actually even brave enough to say to me that this is Nicholas from the branch of the ANC in KZN. I think what you have just said, my brother, is just not good for your career. And I said that, very interesting. Do you have a job lined up? For for me within the organization. Maybe I've just ruined that opportunity. So I'm used to it. And
do you get threats?
I do get SMSs, and I do meet people sometimes who are uncomfortable with what I say. But I always say that for me, it's a question of principle. I mean, I don't care who you are. It's a question of fairness, applying the rules, and looking at the engagement that leaders seems to engage themselves in. And you know, I'll tell you, the only time I felt a little sad about what I've said about someone in the public is when I met President Jacob Zuma himself. You know, because I felt like, oh my God, a while ago I've said this man is a disaster. But when you meet him in person,
he's a very charming, nice guy.
He's amazing.
Right?
I mean, I have had an opportunity to talk to him, to interview him, and you know, when you talk to him, when you take the notes and you go home, you go through your notes, you realize that how could I have been so fooled? He got away. He's amazing. I think he has an incredible emotional intelligence. You ask him straight, are you corrupt? You won't see any giveaway with a body language. He's going to stay calm, take a breath, and go clean 10 on you. Depend what
and
he means by
he holds your hand and
exactly.
He smiles and he laughs and he pats you on the back and you walk away feeling, oh, this is such a good guy.
Exactly. And all the stuff that people are saying about him, for a moment you feel like
it
can't be true. But then you wake up from that reality that, you know what, that's his way of operating.
Also, I suppose he's like that to most of us, but there are people who, once they are not useful to him anymore, he won't be like that with at all.
Exactly.
I think the other side can be just as cruel.
Exactly. He doesn't have permanent friends. I mean, if you look at people who have been around him when he started and people who are around him now, you realize the rotation. He tend to rotate people very quickly and also within key positions in government. And for me, key positions are those that involve police, that involves intelligence. Those are what's understood to be positions that you need to hold on to power, or at least to be a step ahead of your detractors. Those are positions where you see the highest rotation in government. Arts and culture, sports, nobody cares.
Yeah, nobody cares. But he used to be in intelligence, right? That was his thing in Mkhonto we Sizwe. So he understands how important having that information is.
Exactly. And, you know, I also touched on that about his intelligence. I think you can't write about him without outlining the whole mystical character around intelligence, that he was the leader of the Umbokodo, the ANC, and also some of the controversial decisions that he has made back in exile, resulting in some torture of some of the people who were kept there, lost weight and so forth, came back, who were in those camps and were kept in detention within the camps. And for me, when I look at his transition from that time to being in government, if you look at the manner in which he likes to appear in public addressing most of the crises, he likes to be surrounded by intelligence minister all the time, most of the time. He might be attending to something else that you think has got to do with social dissatisfaction. There will be an intelligence person around.
All right, let's get into the detail of it in a moment. But first of all, this is a hell of a provocative title to say when Zuma goes.
It is indeed, you know.
Because you're assuming a lot of things.
Well, one thing that for sure is that he's going to have to go at some point. At least I think I'm right about that one.
Does he
right
think so?
You know what? The question is how he goes, and the question is who and what he leaves behind. I think he's a very smart politician. Hence, I think he will try to have a hand in relation to who's going to follow him. It matters. He has been fighting from day one. From day one, as the president of the country at the ANC, we have been writing obituaries. You see people saying, that scandal, that's it. It's over for him. And then
coming back. He's like Muhammad Ali, right?
Exactly. He comes out and he punches much more rapidly, and he carries on in a way that when you look around, people are dropping. He has the highest number of political casualties in post-apartheid South Africa.
So let's just assume that your title is prescient. Let's assume that you're exactly on the money and that he goes, whether it's in a month, three months, 2 years, whatever it may be. What are the options at this point? Because you say how and what he leaves behind. What are the options for him right now? I mean, there are a lot of things at play. I've heard theories from people who say they reckon he's going to gap it. He's going to run away.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to just abscond mm-hmm. when he realizes he's in too much trouble. And, you know, if you look at what the Guptas have done,
yes,
largely, they've feathered a nest for themselves in Dubai.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have extradition mm-hmm. with a country like that. He could mm-hmm. very easily go and pull an Idi Amin on us and just disappear.
Yeah, he could do that, but I'll tell you what I think. If the basis is that he's alone on this thing, then maybe he will have to run. But I don't think he's alone, Gareth. I looked into the whole thing from far back, 2007, how he was manufactured as man of the people. Remember far back when he came to power, everyone, most people were excited. You might have been the few people who raised concern and have to deal
with
that.
I was excited. You know what happened?
Deal with the public backlash out of
because
that.
Because we all forget. We have a very short memory. The president that we have now was laid low. In 2005-06, he was a nobody. You wouldn't touch him.
Exactly.
He was in the wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
Thabo Mbeki thought he'd been defeated.
Mm-hmm.
They went to Polokwane,
mm-hmm.
and behind the scenes there had been a lot of deal making mm-hmm. and machinations. But then, without anybody seeing what had been anticipated by the very few that Jacob Zuma had been dealing with,
mm-hmm.
he managed to come out of nowhere really. And upset the whole ANC and upset the power structures that Thabo had so carefully put in place.
Exactly.
All the alliances that mm-hmm. he built. And suddenly, before we knew it, there was a change in the leadership of the ANC.
He's the biggest surprise. No one expected him to emerge by then, as you correctly say. Remember when he was a deputy president at some point, he was the head of moral regeneration.
Remember that
project?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It involved, doing some official function here and there, reburial of fallen heroes taken
right.
from
all
the camps.
Stuff.
All those symbolic stuff that actually do not affect the functioning of government. Or even more importantly for me, those stuff that you cannot look at and decide as to what kind of leadership the person has. But South Africa by then had an idea that he was a man of the people, because I think we wanted man of the people. We didn't want anything further to do with Thabo Mbeki. He came in, but I think he went to work from day one. After he came in, we then went on sabbatical as a country and folded our hands and said that, the country is going to be in a good shape. This man is consultative.
Yeah.
He loves the people.
Right.
He's accessible.
People
and
love
so on
him.
Forth. No, wrong. All of that tend to be wrong. What he did, consolidated power within the ANC, and as you said earlier in your intro, built a very complex network of patronage, and at the same time made sure that he's at the forefront of that. The network of patronage, for me, it's so big that even if he wanted to go tomorrow, he wouldn't be allowed to go. So for me,
too many people are feeding off of this network, right?
It's a system. It's a system. Too many people feeding off this network. It's a system that is so big. And I still think that to some extent, as South Africans, we are having a false debate. We tend to think that when he goes as the man, it's a reset button. It's not going to be that, in my view. That is the reason why you see this fight going on at Treasury. What matters, or at the center of this conflict, is how South Africa is going to look like maybe for the next 30 years. Who is it that he's going to anoint to actually follow through, to make sure that the tracks that he has laid will be followed through? It's not going to be an end. I mean, really, if you are facing retirement, you are about you have 2 years to go into your term, why would you engage in such fierce fight if it doesn't matter where the system goes after you? So he's going to go, I think, no doubt about it. But the question is that, my sense is that he's going to leave behind a near impenetrable network of patronage that is so powerful that it will be difficult to deal with.
But surely even that network of patronage is a very fragile thing, because mm-hmm. if you think about it, the people that helped him go to power in mm-hmm. Polokwane, we've got Julius Malema, who's now he's probably his biggest adversary.
Mm-hmm.
You've got people like Zweling Zimavavi, who
Blade.
Was a major supporter. Blade mm-hmm. Nzimande, who was a major supporter. These are people who were in the inner circle
mm-hmm.
of the forces that pushed him into power mm-hmm. in Polokwane. Mm-hmm. Now they're all enemies of his.
Exactly.
And you said he rotates these people very easily. Now, surely the network of patronage is just as fragile. These people mm-hmm. will end up being his enemies just as quickly.
I really think
and they'll start turning on each other once the taps are closed?
The money is the great motivator in this. The question now, what is happening within the ANC is who's going to be able to influence the distribution of resources within the party. If this network actually, I think it pulls people inside. Look at the amount of people who have actually been pulled into the Zuma Gupta thing. You're talking about the likes of Fana Hlongwane. For me, it shows that he has actually even been able to rehabilitate some of the beneficiaries of Mbeki's era and taking them into his term in a way that they start to gain the life of their own, in a way that it becomes the system. Listen to what is happening within the ANC in Free State. Listen to what is happening within the ANC in Northwest. Listen to some part of KZN, what is happening. And I think if you go to the structures of the ANC, you talk to people within the ANC, the dominant view within the structure, not the view that you see leaked in the Sunday Times in the morning. I'm talking about the dominant view at the center is the one that supports him. There are certain people who are saying that there is nothing wrong with what the president is doing. He's under pressure from white monopoly capital. These are the enemies of transformation. They've built that narrative, and I think that narrative, it is going to be tested in the next elective conference of the ANC. Money. It's a big source. Americans play it openly with money.
Okay, we don't. So here are a bunch of people who are at the trough.
Mm.
They're all feeding at the trough right now. But that trough is not getting bigger and bigger. It's getting smaller and smaller because there's less and less money. Mm-hmm. The economy's not growing.
Mm.
There isn't the kind of direct foreign investment that we could tap into before. Yes. Businesses aren't churning out as much money as they used to. Mm. So where is the money coming from to feed the network of patronage?
That is a very interesting point, that we tend to assume that where patronage exists, it will always go against growing the economy. There are people who are stupid, and they might get involved in patronage, but they are stupid, don't have a sense of the economy in force.
Mm.
There are people who are clever, who might actually start to deliver on some of the things while retaining control, while retaining some level of patronage. It's not the case that when you see delivery, there is no longer patronage. What I think might happen, the phase that we might go into when he's gone, is the decline in terms of the open scandal. You might start seeing very clever people getting access to influencing the distribution of resources, and of course helping themselves through some of the deals that are not illegal. Those deals unethical, such as the purchase of the procurement of the nuclear, for example, is one of those deals that you can say it's not really illegal, but it's completely unethical in a sense that you can ask yourself, do we need it, and so
forth. Can we afford it?
Exactly. Yeah. So you're going to have people, I think, surviving within that. They might lessen when it comes to the scandals, but yet I think at the center of this is that South Africa will be almost, I would say, I don't know if you have seen the media report that we are the number one corrupt country. It has been released by Transparency International over the weekend, last week. And I think we're going to get to a point where we start to normalize some of that. We start to accept that
people are furious. I mean, like, you can see it in opposition politics. You can see it within the ANC's usual support structures, that ordinary people are just not, they're not happy in the ANC. They won't vote for them in the last election.
Exactly. People are unhappy, and they're expressing that unhappiness. But there is one thing that I also raise, Gareth, and this is, and I can say this on your radio.
Mm.
I always ask myself, are South Africans really, do they hate corruption, or do they hate the embarrassment and the inconveniences of corruption? I can say to you, I mean, if South Africans hate corruption as a core, as a principal issue, why is it that Julius Malema has had a career after the allegations of corruption as well and fighting within that?
Name a politician.
Exactly.
You know?
So I always ask myself that I don't see a deep-seated resentment against corruption. I see people who are embarrassed about the inconveniences of corruption and about the reporting and all that.
And those very people who are embarrassed are the ones who are bribing Metro Police and that kind of thing, right?
Exactly, they are doing that. And you talk about the opposition. The opposition is... The opposition in this country lacks creativity. All cut across all. The DA is better to some extent because they've got experience. The EFF, they are a newcomer. UDMs and all that. They lack creativity. And I don't think the opposition has it within them to actually unite the nation across race, maybe even across class, and pursue a set of political goals. I haven't seen that.
So who... Besides the president, if he's at the top of this network of patronage, who else has power in this situation? And how powerful people like the Guptas?
Yeah.
How powerful are people like Balegambete?
Very, very interesting. I think that the most powerful forces I see, and I'm comparing with how it works in other countries.
Mm-hmm.
The Premier League, the so-called Premier League.
Right.
The Premier of...
Ace Magashule.
Exactly.
And Supramon Mahumapelo.
Yeah. And
Mabuza.
Didi Mabuza.
Right.
The thing with the Premier League, and as you see the reports, is that they tend to be putting their money where their mouths are. These are the guys who I think they are ahead of South Africans when it comes to lobbying results or lobbying for particular objectives within the ANC. They go into the ANC Youth League elective conference, they get their man. He comes out, he starts swinging right away in their direction. They are in charge of the ANC Veterans League. I have never had the ANC Women's League differing with the Premier League for that matter. For me, this is a consistent performer in recent months, maybe in the last 18 months. They've been performing very consistently. They are putting money, I assume and I think, and I'm reading about it, where they want to achieve a certain set of result. And they might be very influential when it comes to the outcome of the 2017 elective conference of the ANC. Either way, any compromise that is going to come out of that elective conference will have to involve the Premier League. There is no way that they will allow anyone to actually be before their interest.
So if they're doing this, is it so cynical that actually there isn't a principled politician among them, that if you have enough money, you can get whatever you want in South African politics? Is that how it works? Are they all bought?
You know what? I think that we are struggling with what it means to operate democracy in a modern market society. I mean, it's not just about politicians. It's about the society at large as well. I mean, you have this concept in Africa, and I travel a lot across the continent, the idea of a big man. The idea of a guy who shows up with the big car in the village, instead of people asking how did he, or it's a woman, she attained that.
It's
people
hardly are ever saying, a woman, right?
Hardly indeed. People are saying that, you know what, my turn will come. Those are some of the deeper issues in society that we have to deal with. I think that as we have entered this idea of a market society, we have entered the scene of a market society very rapidly. We were not clear on some of the principle. We were quite displaced within that. And I think we have not yet acknowledged the use of money, how it influences our politics. You are not going to stop that. For me, the question is, how do you institutionalize that use of money? You can't. You can't stop the use of money. Look at American politics.
Sure.
Money will always be there. What I think you need to be doing is to open it up. For example, you are saying to the Premier League that, fine, here is the legislation. You're going to tell us how much you are spending on this. Let everybody who has money openly, maybe if they want to, do their activities openly and lobby openly, instead of what we are seeing now, because what we are seeing now is clandestine and the general people think that they're the ones that are making choices. I think that's a problem.
What can ordinary people do in all of this? It sounds pretty dire. I mean, we're not going to be able to change the Premier League. We're not going to be able to change the network of patronage. So what, are we just stuck with whatever we get after this and the country starts to slide inexorably into a situation of the big man, and he's the chief of the tribe, and that's just how it is?
I think that when the political system fails, or when the political system fails to correct itself in a way that, you know, it fails to deal with the question of money, the illicit influence of money in our politics, I think the only thing that ordinary citizens have, the only leverage that ordinary citizens have, is to organize themselves outside political parties, is to actually drive even the discourse outside political parties, instead of allowing politicians to start deciding on the narratives of the day. I think that knowledge, proliferation of information to citizens is the best step. Because if you have knowledge, then you can have a cogent discussion. If you have that, you can take a meaningful position. And that is the reason why you are seeing potential of a shift in areas where you have high concentration of information. Your radio station, you are based here. I would imagine that your highest number of listenership are most likely to be in the province of Gauteng. Rapid flow of information, that's where you start seeing changes, when citizens are also beginning to define what they want from political parties. But so far until now, I don't think citizens have been making that statement very well. They've been voting, no doubt. Voting is one thing, but to define and actually push political parties to behave in a way that citizens want is quite another. We need to get to that stage.
ordinary people who are trying to get educated, to get informed, how do they know that what they're reading? Because we get told by a lot of people in government that the media are part of the problem. You know, and investigative journalism and analysts like yourself, you're actually the third force.
We get called on all sorts of names.
Now, how do people know whether they're getting the truth or not? Or that you aren't, and you and I aren't meeting with a whole bunch of editors of newspapers?
Yeah.
I mean, I've never been invited to these meetings, but let's just imagine that this does happen. That there's a concerted effort to bring down Jacob Zuma in the media. Mm-hmm. The media is not powerful enough to do that on its own, right?
Yeah, I don't think so. And I don't think it has such power. And again, you also need to note that as much as Jacob Zuma has been a disaster, think about what an alternative is from the ANC as well. There are people who have started thinking about that. Some people are saying that, what is the alternative to this politics? The DA seems not to actually be nudging it, seems not to be doing so well. Mm. You have Julius Malema coming up pretty well, but it looks like if he gets in charge, he's going to vandalize the economy if he gets that opportunity.
Mm.
What is it that needs to be done? We need more diversity within the media. We don't need the editorial nonsense that you see at SABC to say give people the right news and all that. You need to have many more radio stations.
More channels.
You need to have more television stations. You need to have more newspaper outlet. I mean,
then let the public decide.
Exactly. If you give people 200 diversified wrong views about something, one of them will actually make its way. And I think, the best society is the one that is characterized by media outlet, many media platforms, so that people can hear the communists, can hear the anarchists, can,
right,
in a day, hear it all. It makes it difficult for you to pick a position, but that's how complex it is to be in a modern society.
We're talking to Ralph Matecha about his new book, When Zuma Goes. Now, who would be the logical successor? Because it was a dead cert that it was going to be Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma for the longest time. Now people are throwing Bale Gambetta into the mix. People are talking still about Cyril, even though I think he's missed a couple of opportunities. Who else is there? Is there anyone else? Is there Zweli Mkhize?
Let me start with Baleka. It's someone who will have a public relations nightmare from day one.
Yeah.
I mean, she has presided over the disastrous handling of the Nkandla report in Parliament. You can't imagine anything more disastrous than that. So disastrous that you wouldn't even want to physically handle the preserved report. Now, after the court ordered the public protector's report should be preserved, that maybe, take this thing off my desk. I don't want anything to do with it.
She's been traumatized.
Exactly. She's totally out. She's totally out that one. But the problem with Cyril is that he's non-committal. He's not forthright.
Yeah, what happened to him?
And I don't see leadership. I don't know how they fight elections in Sweden. I've never watched it happening on our TV. Maybe that's how it goes. Maybe, soft politics and all, and just saying to people that, if you don't mind, vote for me. So that kind of an approach.
Yeah.
You don't win the presidency going into that, going on it in that way. Remember how he became deputy president of the ANC? They actually said that we want to vote against Motlanthe. Would you mind to catch that vote against Motlanthe?
Updraft.
Exactly. He's not going to become the president in the same manner. People, I think, are beginning to raise concerns as to whether, is he a bankable star?
Yeah.
And I don't think he is.
He's not even willing to fight for himself. Why would he fight for us?
He raises a point that government is fighting among itself, government department. President Jacob Zuma says no correction. There is nothing such as that. And Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa quietly goes home, doesn't retort, doesn't come up with any view about that. You really don't want that.
He's especially happy to be number two.
Exactly. Especially in this point, you don't want that. But then comes Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, a liability because of the Zuma name. I mean, the suspicion is that would be an attempt to extend Zuma's hold. We don't know if that is possible. We don't know how close they are. We are speculating. We don't know whether she shares similar beliefs as Zuma. And remember, she also comes from that Mbeki cabinet.
Big time. She's very close to him still. And
exactly.
In fact, you would think her political take on things might be more like Mbeki than like her husband.
Exactly. Exactly. She believes in delivering services. She believes in performance and so forth. So I don't know if her performance in government will exonerate her or maybe mm-hmm. will give her a lifeline, avoid this liability of the Zuma name.
Yeah. Zuelin she could Kize, undermine the network of privilege without anyone knowing.
She could do that, but she need to play it very well. Imagine if she were to be the deputy to Cyril Ramaphosa. If it comes to that, it will be a very interesting mix, I think. Zuelin Mkhize, I'm not really sure. Where are his constituency? Is it in KZN?
Right.
And he left KZN. You see, what's the problem with some of the provinces? You leave, there is a vacuum, it shuts down.
And you never can go back.
You never can go back. KZN has been supporting Zuma nearly unconditionally, at least the stronger half of KZN.
Right.
So it looks as if we might be headed for a compromise, but Zuma will have an influence on who that compromise is.
Let's go to Mike. Hey, Mike, what's up, man?
Morning.
Morning.
Morning, Mike.
Just a few things I'd like to comment on. With regards to, like, education, knowledge, media, freedom, you know, with regards to the set-top boxes and the opening of bandwidth, you know, like converting all TVs to digital, and allowing there to be more TV channels and things like that. It's and how bad education is. It's almost like the ANC has this master plan that we can't really see. You open up education and you have more intelligent voters, you're going to have less ANC voters. If you have more freedom of press, you're going to have more intelligent voters, you're going to have less people voting for the ANC. Do you think this is part of their plan?
To keep people stultified on purpose?
Yes, yes.
As in, and the more simple and the more basic and the more rural you
Absolutely.
Are, and the more
yeah,
you're treated,
the more rural,
like, the more you're treated like a child, the more you'll vote like one.
That's what I feel, because I'm starting to see, like, the tapestry fall away. There's no surprise that certain things, you know, have, like, the influence of... Education could be fixed in this country, but it's not. And we could have a lot more TV channels, but they've delayed it almost for 10 years now. We are up to 20 years behind on TV. Data is expensive. All these things that free the mind are not priorities with the ANC, and I just, someone like him could maybe... give his opinion on that.
Ralph, what do you think of that?
Well, I think that there are certain grand mistakes in government, or maybe some shortfalls in our society. An example being education, where you would say the ANC would benefit out of that.
Yeah.
But I don't really think that they deliberately orchestrated that. And,
so
and
you don't think it's as cynical as that?
No.
They're just incompetent.
Exactly. And Gareth, I believe you can't jail people for being less smart. You can't live in a society such as that which punishes people for being mediocre. And you can't do. We should be tolerant enough to some extent. So I think that is a genuine mistake of the bungling of education and actually failing to even deal with the Fees Must Fall protest. I agree with Helen Zille, was listening. This has got little to do with the fees. It has a lot to do with legitimacy of the leadership where we are now.
Doesn't it suit government too to have distractions like this while there is a real power play going on?
Initially it did. I think this thing just got out of control. I have my theory as to how the whole thing went about. I think initially, you remember government always wanted to regulate these universities, and universities always push back on academic freedom and so forth. And I think that initially when the whole thing started, there was this belief, I think, within government circles that, oh yeah, now the students are going to give it to the university management. Let's let them, you know, we are not going to be part of, let's let them.
We'll get off scot-free.
But the problem became when destination number two became the Union Building, and the students started to demand even more. And the Fees Must Fall was no longer a technical issue. It is now a question of justice, where the students are saying, you can't tell us you don't have money. You just splashed 246 million on Uganda. You can't tell us you don't have money. They are challenging that legitimacy. Those are what I call unintended, you know, consequences of a lack of, you know, focus on the side of the ANC-led government. And regarding the monopoly in the media, that is a concern for me. And I will also blame some that are already established within the media for actually perpetrating the monopoly as well. we are 58, it's about 58 million, the population of South Africa. You can't have 3 24-hour news channel that actually run a 7-hour in the loop through the night and
right.
And everything.
They don't add anything.
Exactly.
New
You need to open up that. The
in
very
one language,
same,
very often.
Exactly. The very same attitude that you've seen in failing to free up the media is the same that your colleague Thibaut Touch went on about
data.
Is because politicians are in on it, they're shareholders at these companies and so, and we don't have a strong civil society to frame these issues in a way that they can gain that momentum. But I think I'm quite impressed by what Thibaut Touch did, and I think it shows that you really don't need organized civil society, which writing a report and all that and getting a funding and spending to drive
create
it.
The momentum.
Exactly, you can create the momentum and carry on with that.
Now, I need to ask you, because you worked as a senior policy analyst at the Treasury for a while.
Yes.
What is going on from your point of view now on the outside, obviously? Inside of Treasury, you would have had close dealings there with Pravin Gordhan.
Mm-hmm.
You would have known the workings of SARS, both under him as commissioner and later on with the change to Tom Moyane and all the bits in between.
Mm-hmm.
Is this battle everything that they say it is in the media? What kind of a constitution does Pravin Gordhan have?
It is everything they say it is, but it. I think it has been there in the past. It's just that there is something about President Thabo Mbeki's leadership. He protected Treasury.
Mm.
Because my experience at Treasury is that Treasury is quite powerful as a government institution. But it's not always powerful because the Constitution says so. It is mostly powerful also because other departments are lazy. They don't do their work. You have a single department that can actually influence policy in other departments.
Right.
If you put a credible person within education, for example, and they go and ask for budget from Treasury, Treasury says no. A credible person can just look at the numbers and say, wait a minute, we've been running a deficit to this point. I think you should prioritize that. But you don't have the ministers in other departments who have been able to actually put up with Treasury. This is why the legend of Treasury grew. And President Thabo Mbeki protected Trevor Manuel against any onslaught from the unions, from some of the leftist civil society organizations, and from some of the populists. Enter President Jacob Zuma. He played ball within that protection of Treasury for a while, but he was always ambivalent. I remember very well, Gareth, when Pravin Gordhan was appointed as a minister, finance minister, and Tlhantlhanene was there as the deputy. And I said it in the public that I have a concern with a minister within the finance who is not strong within the party. If you look at what is happening within the UK, you remember under Tony Blair and so forth, you have had the Treasury minister who actually took over when, I think that is when Tony Blair left or so.
And yeah, it was Gordon Brown.
Gordon Brown, exactly. Yeah. Thank you. And for me, my view was that if you have the minister within Treasury who doesn't have political clout within the ANC, it's going to be a problem because other ministers are just going to have their way. That has began with Pravin Gordhan. He has been undermined by other departments. Remember 2013, around December, Pravin Gordhan issues a guideline under Treasury. No more alcohol. Ministers, department cannot spend on alcohol in those parties.
I remember that.
One Malusi Gigaba goes and slashes credit card in the public saying we are going into austerity. A couple of weeks down the line, Thandi Modise Northwest buys a new BMW 740 for 1 point. It just shows you that Pravin Gordhan never had a political clout to be in Treasury. And now I think maybe the plan by President Jacob Zuma has always been to rein him over a period of time. And that is what we are seeing happening. That for me, it's complex. It comes
all
far.
All of this makes the president look so Machiavellian, though. He's extremely, extremely smart and deft as a politician, right?
Exactly. The thing
and he waits. He'll wait a long time if he has
to. He waits. He waits, and by the time people get their hands on the debate, they've got no clue what they're actually debating. They're caught in this making.
What's the best case scenario for him? That he retires to Nkandla and lives his life?
You know what? I think, don't forget he's also a politician. no matter how good he's performing within Treasury, no matter how great Pravin is, he's a politician as well. I think that he would prefer to be kicked out, you know, a hero's exit. I'm the last guy who stood against Zuma's corruption empire. And
Pravin,
so
this is.
Pravin, yes.
But what's the best case scenario for the president?
For the president is to get a moderate. I think that there's going to be a new finance minister, whether we like it or not. It's going to happen because the reality now is that technically you have a suspect that is going to read out your budget in a week's time or so. That's a fact. Whether we can, we know how it got to where it is, but you're going to have a different finance minister. I think the thinking is, how far can you move from Gordon when it comes to the new finance minister? Can you bring in someone with a little bit of with someone who the market has a little bit of confidence in him or her, and someone who can find their way? There are those people actually who can come and stabilize national treasure. Talks have been around Brian Molefe, who's reported to be captured by the Gupta as well. And I think there is credibility to the statement that he's been captured to a greater extent.
So then he would be a terrible selection.
He has been at Treasury before as the Deputy Director General. He has been at the Public Investment He understands inflation. You can send him to Davos, he'll come back with the good notes from the World Economic Forum that they said this, they said this.
Is there anyone better than him?
There are great people better than him. You can even take the current economic transformation committee of the ANC, Ino Godongwane.
But he said some things about state capture as well.
Yes, he's taken a very strong position against that. But he's one of those people.
Godongwane is actually one of the people who's very clearly placed himself in opposition to the president on many things. So
yeah,
what are the chances he'd get?
He's very clear, but where would a compromise come from? It certainly will not fit squarely within Zuma's faction. It has to be someone nearly in the someone that the market can actually work with. Remember, you don't want the finance minister that the president will disown, because effectively the president has for a long time disowned Pravin Gordhan.
This is complex stuff. I encourage people to take a look at your book. It's called When Zuma Goes. Thank you very much for coming to see us, Ralph.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure to meet you, Ralph Matecha. It is 8 minutes to nine on touchcentral.fm, cliffcentral.com. Here's what you need to know. The most important stuff, the Battle of Mosul. That's right. Has started in Iraq as coalition forces look to take back the city from ISIS. Though hugely outnumbered, the terrorists are determined to put up a fight with their troops using the full extent of their arsenal. This includes the use of suicide car bombers, rocket launchers, snipers, and an entire batch of unreturned Samsung S7 notes. Look out for those. Melanie Trump, that's Melania Trump, has dismissed her husband's recent sexually uncomfortable comments just as boy talk. She really doesn't see much harm in it, especially as in her home country, being grabbed by the pussy is actually a compliment. Boris Becker has spoken out on the Nick Kyrgios ban, saying that he understands what the youngster is going through and the demons that he's encountering. Instead of sulking like a little bitch, though, Becker urges Kyrgios to just try and have sex with as many women as possible, something he did really well back in the 80s. We will see you tomorrow.
This is CliffCentral.com.